to Raisin was a relocation center of the Nazis, halfway on the railroad line to the death camps at Auschwitz. Theresien served to guarantee to Auschwitz a steady supply of raw material, human beings. It served also a public relations purpose for the Nazis. Whenever during the war a neutral nation might protest on the basis of rumors circulated to it of the massive Nazi exterminations, the diplomats would be brought to Theresien. See, there are no ovens, no gas chambers here. We've simply interned the Jews for the duration. What these diplomats did not see, the daily cattle trains filled with human beings traveling eastward. They were scheduled to leave the camp late at night, long after these diplomats had been ushered out the gate. Between 1942 and 1944, some 15,000 children passed through Theresien. There was a school in this camp. Appearances had to be kept up at all costs. But no child ever graduated from this school. Yet somehow, scraps of the writing and of the coloring of these children have survived the war. I would like to read to you this morning a bit of the verse of one of these martyred innocents. When a new child comes, everything seems strange to him. What? On the ground I have to lie? Eat black potatoes? No, not I. I've got to stay, but it's dirty here. Floor, why look, it's dirt, I fear. And I'm supposed to sleep on it? I'll get all dirty. Hear the sound of shouting, cries, and oh, oh, so many flies. Everyone knows flies carry disease. Oh, something bit me. Wasn't that a bed bug? Here in Theresien, life is hell. And when I'll go home again, I can't yet tell. Now, Teddy, who wrote this verse, was cindered at Auschwitz in 1943. He never went home again. But his murderers did. Those who turned on the gas taps, and those who staffed so efficiently Germany's murderously cruel final solution to the Jewish problem, went home. And there, many of them remain to this day, happy, prosperous burghers, enjoying their fireside and their beer. Conservative estimates place the number of people exterminated by the Nazis in these camps during the Second World War at 7.5 million. At the end of the war, 5,025 Germans were tried and convicted by the Allied courts. Since that time, 5,445 other individuals were tried by the courts of the Federal German Republic and convicted. But many of these were sentenced to incredibly short terms. Typical of the mood and of the sentence in which the so-called Nazi war crimes trials have taken place is the recently completed action against two men, one Otto Hunsch and one Hermann Krumme. These two men were named by Adolf Eichmann in his trial in Jerusalem as the organizers and the expediters of the deportation, the extermination of 435,000 Hungarian Jews. Mr. Hunch was declared not guilty. Mr. Krume was sentenced to 5 years in jail, and he will not have to serve a single day. He walked out after his conviction a free man because he had been incarcerated pending trial. The German courts subtracted sufficient time for good behavior to let him go free. The good German judge, concerned with good German justice, with proper legality, was unwilling to accept the testimony of Adolf Eichmann. After all, he was a known criminal. And the good German judge, concerned with good German justice, was also not willing to accept the testimony of the Israeli Joel Brandt. The Israeli who had tried to engineer with Krume the famous Trucks for Jews deal, which was attempted in 1943. Mr. Brandt and other Israelis, according to this judge, were too emotionally involved in their testimony. German justice has been remarkably foot-dragging and scandalously incongruous in the handling of the Nazi war crimes. 1964, this past year, 22 individuals were tried under major charges. These 22 men stood accused of implicated in the death of over 500,000 men, women, and children. Their sentences, 2 were sentenced to life, 4 were sentenced to less than 15 years, 12 were sentenced to from 3 to 6 years, and 4 were acquitted. As one irate and indignant prosecutor put it, "We sometimes receive sentences which amount to 10 minutes in jail for every person killed." It was not until 1958 that the German government could be prodded to begin a systematic investigation of Nazi war crimes. It was only in 1958 that the Central Bureau to Investigate Nazi War Crimes was established, and that the Germans began to burrow into the very complete and systematic records kept by their Gestapo and their secret police. And not surprisingly, in the sense symbolic of this whole masquerade, the man who was head, the senior investigator of this legal proceeding against the Nazi war criminals, was unmasked 6 weeks ago by the East German government as a former head of the Hitler Youth. A trickle of men have perforce come before the German courts, and their trials have been legally narrow, and their sentences have been unconscionably gentle, tantamount to a wrist slap here and a verbal reprimand there. German public opinion has not wanted to have these trials. The past, Germany hopes, is behind it. She wants to be forgiven. She wants the world to believe that there is a new Germany, a new mood. The Hitler era was an aberration, that there is no carryover between then and today. A recent poll of Germans by the respected Wickert Institute showed that over 70% of the German people favored an immediate cessation of these war trials. The German press, sensitive to the national mood, has been writing articles on the theory of what is called Gleichberechtigung, which means simply, we alone are not guilty. We are more sinned against than sinners. Recently, the National Zeitung, just a month ago, published a long catalog of British violence, beginning with some action in the year 609 in which Celtic kings murdered a few nuns, going down through British action in Ireland, South Africa, the Sudan, India, including even the bombings of Berlin and Dresden and Hamburg during the Second World War. We alone are not guilty. We are more sinned against than sinners. Gleichberechtigung. Now, where there is a will, where a government wants to have a popular political platform on which to stand for election, a way can always be devised. Words can always be found. A rationalization can always be written. And the words in this case were found within the Weimar Constitution, which remains the basic law of the Federal Republic. And they were found by the Bonn Minister of Justice, who, by the way, is himself an ex-Nazi, who was disbarred for 6 years at the end of the war for his actions under Hitler. And they were found in a provision of that Constitution which says that there shall be a statute of limitations of 20 years for criminal action. May of 1965 represents the deadline, 20 years since the end of the war. And Herr Hart, who must stand for election in September of this year, who saw here a popular program announced in early fall of 1964, that May would indeed be the deadline for such action. After May, no more investigation of Nazi crimes and no prosecution would be initiated. An international furor erupted. It was not only among Jews along the breadth of Europe, for all Europe was crushed under the iron-nailed boot of the Nazi. France and Holland announced that they had lifted their own statute of limitations for these specific crimes, the category of crimes against humanity. Poland announced that she was going to conduct a year-long campaign of protest against the West German action. East Germany lifted its own statute of limitations and threatened to reveal from its own archives the record of tens upon hundreds of West German officials whose past histories implicated them during the Nazi period. Now, it would appear as of this moment that within a week or two, the West German parliament will indeed prolong the terminal date for Nazi war crime prosecution. The reason does not lie in conscience or in guilt. No great victory has been won or will be won for humanity. Germany simply stumbled politically once too often. There intervened between last fall and this spring the fiasco of the Bonn-Cairo relationships, the abrogation of the arms contract agreement with Israel. The political soup had simply become too sticky. Herr Erhard could not stick to this one decision. And so the trials will go on, slowly, shoddily, meaninglessly, and with implausibly injust, unjust sentence. Now I confess that Germany's mulish, clumsy handling of this whole war crimes episode has revived my suspicions of the new Germany. Oh, I know that the Germans prate in the public press that they must be law-abiding, that it was their playing, their circumvention of the law, which during the Hitler days allowed Hitler to come to power. I wish Germany would indeed live by its law. But unfortunately, Germany can bend this law when it finds it expedient to do so. It is against German law and against its own constitution for a German national to hire himself out as a mercenary to a foreign power or as a mercenary scientist, a technician, whose sole purpose is to build up the military machine of some other nation. The existence of German scientists in Cairo, Alexandria, where they are building Mr. Nasser's machine, his jet weaponry and his missiles, is an open secret. Israel has protested their presence for 2 years and more. The German Constitution forbids their presence there in Cairo, but the scientists remain. And the West German government, with its vaunted concern for the law, has failed to invoke its own law. I confess that I have grave doubts about a new Germany. Prejudice does not erase so simply. But my concern is not only narrowly Jewish. I've long since given up the hope that Germany was repentant. The German conscience had been pricked. Germany wanted to realign its thousand-year bitter history towards the Jew. Germany has yet to recognize the State of Israel. Germany has yet to recall its scientists. Germany was quite willing last month to break unilaterally an arms agreement with Israel. Germany's conscience is remarkably thick-skinned. What is good for Germany is good for Germany. If the Jew suffers, so be it. My concern rather is with European peace and with the peace of the world. You know, we Jews are in a sense the weather vane of mankind. When the cold winds blow, we are the first to know it, to be chilled and shiver. And Germany's actions towards Israel and towards the Jewish people in the past months have caused us to shiver, to be cold. It's time that we called out to the world to make them realize German ambition flames. Germany again is making the motions to be full territoried, to come alive. And a lively Germany has meant a death-ridden Europe. The facts are well known and can be briefly stated. Germany has been interested in the last years, as have all the nations of the world, in the economic potential, the market of the Near East. The German government has invested some $70 million of loans with Mr. Nasser and has guaranteed the investment of some $300 million of equipment and materiel by its own industrialists. It shows here only the normal greed of normal government relationships. Our own government is equally involved. Germany is interested in the markets, in the potential, in the Suez, in the oil, in the land. Drang nach Osten. Movement East. He's always been. This is not surprising. But what is surprising is that this greed, this normal international greed, can be overwhelmed by a single passion, a single concern. For Germany in the last weeks has put in jeopardy all of this investment. Why? Out of fear. What is the fear? The Arab nations, especially the United Arab Republic, will recognize the legitimacy of the East German government at Pankow. Mr. Nasser, as you well know, has been the tool of the Soviet, the communist bloc, for many months. He first tried to play East against West, and for a long time now he has played largely with the East. He has sponsored a socialist rebellion in the Yemen. He is sponsoring and equipping and sending his officers to the Congolese rebels in Central Africa. He is putting pressure on the Libyan king to force us out of our giant Air Force base at Wheeler. He is playing the game of Moscow. And he is establishing all manner of political and commercial and military agreement with the Russian and the satellite states. Herr Ulbricht, head of the East German government, was to go to Cairo to establish some commercial contact and contract. Mr. Nasser was to welcome him. Mr. Nasser indeed did welcome him. But the West German government was concerned that involved in this welcome would be the recognition of East Germany. There is the famous Hallstein Doctrine, which holds as a basis of the foreign policy of West Germany, that she must withdraw her counsels and withdraw recognition from any nation, which in fact does recognize East Germany. German policy is focused, even at the cost of its own economic advantage. German policy is focused to the East, on territory, what is labeled reunification. Troubled, disturbed, West Germany appeared to appeal to that old friend of democracy, Generalissimo Franco, to use his good offices to adjust the differences between Cairo and Bonn. And a certain Marquis de Nerva was sent to Cairo. Nasser scented advantage and political leverage, and he was happy to agree. Yes, he would not officially recognize West Germany. It was easy not to do. If the West German government would renounce its arms contract with Israel, and if the West German government would agree never to recognize the state of Israel. West Germany was delighted. Herr Schroeder, German foreign minister, had never been in favor of the old Adenauer-Ben-Gurion arms agreement. German interests lie with the mighty, with the large, with the Suez, with the oil. Israel was an embarrassment, realpolitik, in which he was a technician, that in which Germany has always been the expert, called out for a breaking of the ties with Israel. The psychology which had drawn Germany to Israel was embarrassing. Yes, Herr Schroeder was happy to break this contract. Although he was not quite as happy when the Marquis de Nerva revealed the secret protocol that the West German government had agreed never to recognize the state of Israel, this was embarrassing. The West, especially those nations in which there is a large Jewish public opinion, might not like it. And so it was announced in Bonn that another contract, another treaty, another agreement had been scrapped by another German government. And then Bonn was surprisingly chagrined at the explosion of anger, the furor which erupted in its actions. After all, we promised them blood money, reparations. You could almost hear in the councils in Bonn the echo of the old anti-Semitic stereotype. You give a Jew money, what more does he want? Bonn was chagrined that there was this excessive anger in Jerusalem. And Bonn was disturbed that a number of American Jewish businessmen and others, in an impromptu action, began an embargo for their own companies of further imports of West German goods. So, the matter lay. Germany was disturbed, and the world was disturbed because of Germany. But what is the focus in which all this must be assessed? Simply this. The fires of ambition burn brightly in the Reich. Once upon a time, in the years immediately at the end of the Second World War, under the leadership of Konrad Adenauer, German policy was focused to the West. There was talk, as you recall, of a united Europe. Germany would be economically and politically integrated into the West. And the interest of France and of the Low Countries in peace and in principle, the supposed new interest of the German politician, would guarantee that Germany would not again trample over the world. But since Mr. Adenauer has left office, the focus of German policy has changed. Germany's eyes are now not on the West, but on the East. We have not heard much of this in the United States, but Europe knows it, and knows it well. General de Gaulle devoted the better part of his last press conference to this specific point. And he said this: Europe has reason always to be darkly suspicious whenever Germany sets out in search of herself. Under Konrad Adenauer, German policy was focused on a united Europe. That interest lags. German eyes are to the East. And he warned West Germany that reunification cannot take place except through war. And the other nations of Europe were not prepared to tolerate a German policy which might precipitate war. Now, I know that our own government, through four administrations, has made the reunification of Germany elemental in our foreign policy. With all due respect, the State Department does not always reveal the word of God to Moses at Mount Sinai. The reunification of Germany, yes, sometime. But no one has answered the simple question, the fundamental question, how is it to be achieved? Can you imagine the communist world giving up a large block of its territory to the free enterprise world? Can you imagine the free enterprise world giving up a large block of our territory to the communist camp? How is reunification to be achieved? By war? And what is Germany? What is Germany? Many a German textbook colors in as German territory large blocks of land which the Poles believe belong to them. Hitler believed that the legitimate boundaries of Germany were the Baltic, the Mediterranean, and the Atlantic. A member of the Parliament arose in Bonn just a month ago and reasserted the legitimate claims of Germany to the Sudetenland. Shades of 1936 and 7 in Munich. Are we to go through another decade of German claims to the Tsar, to Alsace-Lorraine, to the Sudeten, to the Polish corridor, to Danzig? Has this not always been the road to war? Reunification may be an ultimate essential to a stable Europe. I admit that the division of Europe, east and west, and through the middle of Germany is artificial. But what boundary of Germany is not artificial? Except perhaps the boundaries of Europe. Our own reaction, State Department's reaction to the events of the past week shows that we have utterly misinterpreted their import. Our concern has been to smooth over the relationships for West Germany with Israel, with Cairo, with Spain, wherever these relationships are frayed. Our concern has been, as always, the stability, the security of the West German government. Germany is predictably anti-Russia. Russia has always been the great threat to Germany in Europe over the 1,000 years. And we have made the keystone of our policy in Europe the strengthening and the arming of West Germany. We see this as the great roadblock to Russian ambition. Well and good. But is this answer sufficient? Are we prepared to continue to give to the Bonn government a blank check to back up its political ambition? We were disturbed by Israel's anger at German action. Mr. Avril Harriman was uprooted from the sands of Palm Beach and precipitously jetted over to Tel Aviv to smooth Israeli tempers. Perhaps out of this may come some direct arming of Israel by the United States. Perhaps out of this there may come a realization in Washington that the only basis of security in the Near East is a political arrangement between Israel, the only democracy in the Near East, and the United States by which we guarantee the boundaries and the territory of Israel. Russia has poured into Nasser's army $1 billion worth of sophisticated weaponry in the last 10 years. In December of this last year, the United Arab Republic and Russia signed the fourth of their series of arms agreements. Mr. Nasser now has 15,000 modern heavy tanks. More than all the tanks that the Allies and the Germans had and fought with each other in Africa in the Second World War. Nasser now has in Egypt the most powerful jet air force outside of Europe and of this continent. And Nasser has the German scientists building him the ground-to-ground missiles and the jet weaponry which can carry the nuclear warhead. Perhaps Washington will come to see the need to make clear what has so far only been hinted, to make explicit what has so far never been written, that our ultimate concern is with freedom, with the free, with democracy, and with those who practice it, and that the American government will not allow this little outpost of freedom to be destroyed, crushed by another dictator. Perhaps so. We have yet to see. Now, government responded to Herr Knapstein's, the German ambassador to the United States, visit to the State Department by assuring Mr. Knapstein, that our government looked with disfavor upon such impromptu boycotts, that the boycott was not a normal form of international activity, and we did not espouse it. Letters and telephonic communication was begun in Washington to those American business people who had begun this spontaneous action. Well, in all the years that the official Arab boycott against any company which did business with Israel has been in effect, we have never been able to get from the State Department a similar statement. The Arab boycott has never been officially condemned. And the State Department has found ways to circumvent its operation in our aid program, in our military program, and elsewhere where it affects our policy. The American reaction to the West German Cairo imbroglio was simply to smooth the way for an ally that had stumbled badly in its international relations. We failed utterly to see what the German action means, what it represents, the fires which lie behind it. Failed utterly to recognize that now is the time for a major reassessment of our German policy. Are we prepared to go the whole hog with Germany as Germany maneuvers now to be reunified? Are we prepared to accept the threat of war implicit in this policy? Some will say, Rabbi, as a Jew, you are understandably passionate. Could it not be that your reactions are excessive? That you fail to see the new Germany because your eyes are grayed over by the fires lit by the old? Perhaps. But you know, the world would have been far better off if it had listened to its Jews in 1930, in 1931, 1932, and we cried out, and the world said, there is a new Germany. Germany will be satisfied with the Tsar. We can do business with Hitler. We Jews have had a 1,000-year bitter history in and with Germany. We know the German soul. We can sense when there is a change in German heart. Survival is dependent on it. And our defense mechanisms are sharp. We read the message clear. Let me end as I began by reading to you from the literature of death. This is the work of a 12-year-old who never became 13. Today, the ghetto knows a different fear, close in its grips. Death wields an icy scythe. An evil sickness spreads a terror in its wake. The victims of its shadow weep and writhe. Today a father's heartbeat tells his fright, and mothers bend their heads into their hands. Now children choke and die with typhus here. A bitter tax is taken from their bands. My heart still beats inside my breast while friends depart for other worlds. Perhaps it's better, who can say, than watching this. Perhaps it's better to die today. No, no, my God, we want to live, not watch our numbers melt away. We want to have a better world. We want to work. We must not die. We want to have a better world. Peace is the fundamental substructure, the foundation on which such a world must be built. Peace can come only when the fires of German ambition have been fully quenched and put out. The time is now, before the flame burns high, while there are still controls, while the West and decency still count. Amen.